content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first story today is entitled, When a Telescope is a National Security Risk. This was written by Ross Anderson. In the early months of 2023, the astronomer Gelko Evezich found himself taking part in a highly unusual negotiation. Evezich is the 59-year-old director of the Vera Rubin Observatory, a $1 billion telescope that the United States has been developing in the Chilean high desert for more than 20 years. He was trying to reach an agreement that would keep his telescope from compromising America's national security when it starts stargazing next year. This task was odd enough for any scientist, and it was made more so by the fact that Evezich had no idea with whom he was negotiating. I didn't even know which agency I was talking to, he told me on a recent video call from his field office in Chile. Whoever it was would communicate with him only through intermediaries at the National Science Foundation. Evezich didn't even know whether one person or several people were on the other side of the exchange. All he knew was that they were very security-minded. Also, they seemed to know a great deal about astronomy. The Vera Rubin is housed in a sleek building on a mountaintop in the Atacama Desert. The chamber that holds its primary mirror juts up from the end of the elongated structure, like the head of a sphinx. The observatory represents a freakish augmentation of human vision. Like the James Webb Space Telescope that NASA launched a few years ago, it will be able to see to the far edge of the universe. But the Webb can only observe a tiny region of the sky. The Vera Rubin will be able to lock onto a tile of sky that is much larger and, after 30 seconds, return an image of that tile that extends 13 billion light years into space. Then it will pan over and lock onto an adjacent tile of sky and do the same thing. And after just 3 nights of going tile by tile like a handyman redoing a bathroom wall, it will have captured a deep image of the entire sky. National security types worry about what the Vera Rubin will be able to see. Evezich told me that each of its full sky images will contain more than 40 billion objects. That's several times more than all previous surveys of this sort combined. When the Vera Rubin sees an object that it hasn't seen before, it will alert astronomers. If a star explodes billions of light years away, an algorithm will spot it, and the community will be notified. If a near-Earth asteroid comes hurtling right toward us, scientists will know to zoom into it immediately with other observatories. The problem is, if a spy satellite or some other secret spacecraft moves into view, that too could get flagged and have its location distributed in real time to people all across the world. The Pentagon doesn't like much of anything to be known about its satellites. During the Cold War, the United States was more secretive about what it did in space than what it did in the nuclear realm, says Aaron Bateman, a historian at George Washington University and the author of Weapons in Space. The U.S. acknowledges the general contours of its nuclear arsenal, how many weapons and delivery vehicles it has, but tends to be far more circumspect about its military space capabilities. Bateman told me that the very existence of the National Reconnaissance Office, the agency responsible for developing U.S. spy satellites, was classified until 1992. The NRO still operates a fleet of these satellites, but the exact details about how many and what kind remain secret. The Vera Rubin Observatory will likely make awkward eye contact with some of them. Many of them are telescopes in their own right, but instead of tilting up toward the sky, they point down at Earth. This dual nature of the telescope dates back to its inception. after inventing his, Galileo wrote to the ruler of Venice about its ability to spy enemy ships. He also vowed to keep the device a secret. During the early Cold War, the British government monitored Soviet satellites and missile tests with the Jodrell Bank Observatory in Manchester. Assistance of this kind has also flowed in the opposite direction, from the spies to the civilians. During the Apollo missions, NRO spy satellites captured images of potential landing sites on the moon. They also inspected damaged panels on the Skylab, NASA's first space station. In 1981, during the space shuttle's maiden flight, a NASA astronaut flipped the shuttle over so that an NRO satellite could grab a close-up of its heat shield to see how it had held up through the atmospheric friction. Only a few people at the agency were aware of this operation. The public learns about the true extent of the government's seeing powers only after a long lag. The space historian Dwayne Day recently told me that the intelligence community operated large optics in space before NASA even started working on the Hubble in 1977. He said that the technology helping today's ground-based observatories see through the blur of the atmosphere was first developed by the military and then later shared with civilian astronomers. The NRO may have all kinds of telescopes. In 2012, the agency even gave NASA a Hubble-class observatory as a surprise gift. It had just been lying around. Evazich knew that the Vera Rubin Observatory would need to avoid revealing the full extent of America's space-based surveillance apparatus. He agreed to set up a system that would remove classified information from the telescope's images. But he and his mysterious interlocutors did not initially agree on how it should work. Some of their concerns were easy to assuage. The Defense Intelligence Agency sometimes asks to be informed when foreign nationals use America's most powerful radio observatories, in case those people were to point them at something sensitive, presumably. No such protocols would be necessary for the Vera Rubin's Chilean operators because the telescope has a fixed 10-year observation plan. Evazich said he showed it to his government counterparts and assured them that no one would be able to deviate from it. Evazich was most worried about the possibility that he would be made to adopt a system like the one the Air Force had imposed on a much less powerful astronomical survey called Pan-STARRS about a dozen years ago. The images taken by that project's telescopes in Hawaii were routed to a military facility, the dark side, as Evazich put it, where they were edited before being sent on to astronomers. The editors weren't especially surgical. You would get back your image and all the military assets would be blacked out, Evazich told me. It looked like someone had streaked a marker across it, and it had a huge impact on the science that people were able to do. After some back and forth, Evazich said he and his counterparts came up with a less invasive way to remove secret American assets from the observatory's instant alerts. A government agency, no one told him which one, would chip in $5 million for the construction of a dedicated network for moving sensitive data. Each time the telescope were to take one of its 30-second tile images of the sky, the file would be immediately encrypted without anyone looking at it first, then sent on to a secure facility in California. Next, an automated system would compare the image with previous images of the same tile. It would cut out small postage stamp pictures of any new objects it finds, be they asteroids, exploding stars, or spy satellites. It would filter out the postage stamps that might depict secret U.S. assets and, 1 minute later, send all the rest, together with their coordinates, to an alert service available to astronomers worldwide. 3 days and 8 hours later, the entire tile image would be released to the astronomers, untouched by black marker or any other technology of redaction. By then, the spy satellites would likely have gone somewhere else. They are elusive, after all. Their orbits are irregular, and they shift direction often. Not even the world's most accomplished astronomers would be able to infer their present locations from a line of sight streaking through a three-day-old image. Evazich told me that the length of the data embargo was the most difficult term to work out. He had initially asked for the full images to be released after 10 hours. He said that his negotiating partners wanted it to be closer to 7 days. In the end, Evazich was happy with the middle ground that they settled on. This account of the negotiation comes primarily from Evazich himself. National Science Foundation and Department of Energy staff confirmed some of the general outlines of his story, but would not disclose with whom he had been negotiating, or the name of the agency that paid for the encrypted network. The Space Force declined to comment on the process. The NRO said it had no information to offer me about any observatories. Evazich had nothing bad to say about his mysterious interlocutors. To the contrary, he told me they seemed genuinely concerned about the risk of compromising the Vera Rubin science mission. They did not come and say, "The law is on our side, you must do this, and that's the end of it," Evazich said. "After all, we are spending $1 billion of the government's money," he added, with a laugh. Our second story, Journalism's What If Problem, by Noah Hawley. When I was growing up in New York in the 1970s, the city was at its nadir. Bankruptcy, burned-out buildings, rampant crime. I started in public school, then switched to private in the fifth grade. My parents made the change, because they said if I went to the local middle school, I would be knifed in the halls. This was an act of fiction. I say it was an act of fiction not because getting knifed was an impossibility, but because it was speculative, one of many potential futures. In reality, thousands of kids went to intermediate school 70 that decade and were never knifed or threatened with a knife, though some were. In my house, the fear of that potential future was strong enough for my dad to take on extra work and make the change. As a novelist and filmmaker, I spend a lot of time thinking about the value of fiction. I tell stories to help me understand my world and the people in it. My job is to create feelings in the audience, fear and longing, joy and anger. When I consider the author's role in our culture, I picture the following sequence. First comes news, then comes history, then comes fiction. Novelists and filmmakers are the cleanup crew, parsing meaning from the historical realities we have shared. But over the past 10 years, I've noticed something at first puzzling, then alarming. Fact and fiction are trading places in the sequence. I first saw evidence of this phenomenon during the coverage of the 2016 Republican National Convention. Halfway through the week, a CNN anchor noted in an interview with Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, that violent crime was down in the country. But Gingrich argued that this was just one view and that people feel more threatened. The CNN anchor insisted, "Feel it, yes, they feel it, but the facts don't support it." Without missing a beat, Gingrich said, "As a political candidate, I'll go with how people feel, and I'll let you go with the theoreticians." This was an early sign that we were moving, perhaps had already moved, from a fact-based world to a fictional one, where how people feel about crime is as real as the crime itself. My feelings, your feelings, everybody's feelings are facts, and facts of equal value to actual reality. Crime is up because I feel like crime is up, and you will never convince me otherwise, because my feeling is a fact. Now, feelings, as I've suggested, are meant to be a purview, of fiction writers. We construct our stories around the feelings of our characters. How they feel drives their actions. Feelings are not traditionally how we as humans understand reality, how we filter events into first news and then history. Those are assembled, in a perfect world, from actual facts, an objective recording of events that occurred. The motivations of the players matter, certainly, but the feelings of the reader, of the observer? How can we how we feel about what happened in the world cannot change what happened, can it? That was one sign. Another was the rapid proliferation of alternative narratives. In the old days, when news happened, the media would report the facts. Two planes crashed into the Twin Towers, which then collapsed. Only later would conspiracy theories emerge. 9/11 was an inside job, for example. Then came January 6th, an event that unfolded as fact and fiction simultaneously. While the mainstream media showed us footage of Donald Trump's supporters storming the Capitol in real time, Fox News, other right-wing outlets, and social media told people that the riot they were watching was actually the work of Antifa. And so, before our eyes, the fictional version of the moment was born at the same instant as the reality. These days, MAGA's fictions focus primarily on the present. They're eating the dogs. They're eating the cats. And the past, a stolen election, stories of when America was great. But this process of fictional thinking is not restricted to the right. More and more mainstream news sources are also engaging in acts of fiction. Rather than the past or present, however, their fictions focus primarily on the future. During the 2024 election, that fiction revolved around what could happen if Trump were reelected. Dark speculation about all the ways in which it would bring the end of democracy. Earlier this year, for instance, this magazine published a collection of essays under the headline, If Trump Wins. Now that he has, the speculation has only increased. Each new cabinet appointment produces speculation about soldiers in the street, 10 million migrants deported, Nancy Pelosi thrown in jail. Like any potential knifing in the middle school halls, these consequences are not impossible. Trump has, in fact, threatened to do all these things, nor are they even unlikely. But their exhaustive discussion in the same sources that report the facts of the day confuses Americans about what role the news media are supposed to play in our society, which is to report the facts and let the audiences form an opinion. Speculation is not the function of journalism. It is what an anxious brain does, worrying about all the ways things could go wrong, sending the worrier into a panicked and angry state. The same state of mind, I would add, that consumes Fox News viewers. In the past 20 years, Fox has made billions off of its viewers' anxiety, the fear its hosts inspire, motivating those viewers to watch more and more Fox in a cause-and-effect spiral. You can argue that there's no equivalency, that replicating facts with fiction in the present is dangerous, while painting pictures of potential disasters is simply being prepared. My point, though, is not that news organizations are inventing the threat to democracy. My point is that when they fill their needs with what-ifs, they degrade the exercise of journalism. This is not a new phenomenon. 24-hour cable news networks and talk radio were the original alarmists. But in a country where the news media itself are polarized between our sources and their sources, we should consider the idea that how journalists report the news may be as important as the news itself. And if the definition of crazy is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result, then journalists should examine the possibility that nearly a decade of resistance has had the opposite effect as it was intended. There is a larger story here about how algorithms push content with high emotional impact into our feeds and how clicks and likes drive advertising dollars. That is a story about how news is a for-profit business. But to the degree that this is a story about how news organizations approach the job of informing Americans about the events and personalities of the day, I'm going to keep it simple and say that by using the tools of fiction to stir feelings of fear and anger, news platforms undermine the real value of their news and impair people's ability to consider it clearly. One day in the not-too-distant future, history books will be written about what actually happened in the second Trump term. Then the fiction writers will descend looking for meaning, and having mediated, met having meditated on the realities we've experienced, the truth we've uncovered. And if it turns out we were all knifed in the halls, we will write about that as well. But until then, I think we are all best served by focusing on what is happening, not what might. Our third story is going to have to be edited slightly for time. It's called A New Reckoning for Nuclear Energy and was written by Mateo Wong. This spring kicked off the best stretch for America's nuclear industry in decades. It started in April when, for the first time since 1990, the United States added nuclear capacity for the second year in a row. In June, Congress passed a major law to accelerate nuclear energy development. The Republican Party's national platform trumpeted nuclear power, as did Kamala Harris in describing her economic goals. This fall, three of the world's largest companies, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, announced substantial investments in nuclear energy facilities. In November, the U.S. issued official goals to massively expand its nuclear capacity. "We have ambitious targets for the next 10 years, Michael Goff, acting Assistant Secretary for the Department of Energy's Office of Nuclear Energy, told me. The DOE, aims to add roughly 60 times more nuclear power in a quarter century than the century built in the previous one. As recently as 15 years ago, or perhaps even five, imagining all of this would have been a stretch. For decades, the industry was stagnant and vehemently opposed by environmentalists. But nuclear energy, a potential source of abundant, reliable, emissions-free electricity, is a powerful tool to fight climate change. And now the federal government, major companies, and a growing number of climate advocates are supporting a series of nuclear energy projects that could transform America's grid. This is at least the country's third attempt to do so. The original push to install a nationwide fleet of reactors ground to a spectacular halt in the 1980s. This round, the industry itself has really got to deliver, Goff said. America's opposition to nuclear power runs deep. Some of the oldest and most influential environmental groups, including Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, and the Natural Resources Defense Council, have long opposed the fallout from nuclear weapons testing, and by extension, the environmental risk of nuclear power plants. Broader public attitudes turned against nuclear power when Pennsylvania's Three Mile Island facility suffered a meltdown in 1979. The Democratic Party opposed new nuclear plants the following year. And after the Chernobyl accident in 1986, nearly three-quarters of Americans said they were against building of a nuclear plant within 5 miles of their home. Economic factors might have doomed nuclear build-out anyway. Energy companies did build many nuclear power plants in the 1970s, and those plants still provide about one-fifth of the United States' electricity today. But skyrocketing costs and interminable construction delays, combined with a plateauing electricity demand, eventually made the new facilities unattractive investments. The result has been that from 1979 to 1988, 67 reactors were canceled. For more than three decades, the nation has barely added any new nuclear capacity. The reactors that did open these were years behind schedule. Beginning in the 1960s, the number of nuclear engineering degrees granted each year steadily climbed to a peak of roughly 1,500 in 1978, then plummeted to less than 400 by 2000. But then, slowly, Americans started studying nuclear engineering again. The reason people are in nuclear now is the environment. Beginning in the 2000s, greenhouse gas emissions and all their consequences for the planet were becoming a pressing concern for a growing number of scientists, government officials, and even corporations. The link between commercial nuclear power and the Cold War and nuclear radiation had faded. More people learned that the technology was safer than fossil fuels or even wind power, measured by deaths per unit of energy produced. As more places in the U.S. started building more renewable energy, Experts found that the decarbonized grid running purely on solar panels and wind turbines might be impossible. The Department of Energy estimates, for instance, each unit of energy from a renewable grid with nuclear power will cost 37% less than from a grid without. In the past decade or so, more scientists and advocacy organizations began to mobilize around nuclear power. The Clean Air Task Force concluded that nuclear energy was the most advanced and proven source of carbon-free, weather-independent power. And the group's executive director, Armin Cohen, who was a staunch anti-nuclear activist in the 1980s, told me. Billions of dollars in corporate investment have gone to nuclear facilities and startups. Similar support exists across states as politically varied as Texas, California, Pennsylvania, and New York. One more factor has propelled the nuclear industry. After decades of relatively flat power use nationwide, AI and data center growth are sending projections for electricity demand soaring upward, Goff said. Because many of the companies operating large data centers have made substantial climate commitments, they need abundant sources of carbon-free electricity and see nuclear as the quickest and most reliable way of generating it. These tech giants' firms appear willing to pay above market rates to get those new nuclear power sources up and running. I just can't think of any precedent for it, Matt Bowen, a nuclear energy researcher at Columbia, told me. Two recently completed reactors at a Georgia power plant, the project that made 2023 and 2024 the first consecutive years of added nuclear capacity in decades, have made the facility the nation's largest single source of clean energy, but both were years behind schedule. Meanwhile, the advanced nuclear projects drawing attention from federal government and tech companies will need to prove their case. These technologies are smaller and simpler than the behemoth facilities of old, which should reduce costs and construction times. But more and more advanced nuclear technologies have been the industry's promised future for decades now. An industry with so many decades of setbacks and failures cannot afford many more. If nuclear power really is so vital to decarbonization, then neither can the climate. The door is open for nuclear power, Cohen told me. The question is whether we can have an industry that can walk through. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.